I'm very pleased to announce or introduce as a guest today Dr. Daniel Sevin, who is a senior researcher at the Columbia Astrophysical Laboratory. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's really nice to be here.
So you work in the field of laboratory astrophysics, is that correct?
Okay, so laboratory astrophysics has a rich history dating back to the 19th century. Fraunhofer first looked at spectra from the sun in the early 1800s, and since then, laboratory scientists have been trying to reproduce spectra of the sun, other stars, and other cosmic objects in the laboratory to understand what's going on.
And so what are the goals of laboratory astrophysics?
Basically, what we're trying to do is understand what's happening in the cosmos. So what I personally do is I do a survey of where the state of knowledge is in the field. What are the leading questions in astrophysics? And then I ask how our understanding of the astrophysics is limited by uncertainties in the atomic and molecular physics that produce the observed spectra. And based on my conclusions, I then either design experiments or find theorists who can do the calculations necessary to generate the needed atomic and molecular data.
And so the atomic and molecular data is used to extract physical conditions from the spectra, is that correct?
Yeah, I can give a really simple example, like just because I've used this word spectra a lot so far, and those people listening may not actually know what a spectrum is. If you imagine you take the light from the sun and you put it through a prism, it gives you a rainbow of colors. If you put the spectrum, the light from the sun, through an instrument called a spectrometer, it stretches that rainbow out so that what looks like a continuous band of color begins to break down into individual lines of color. And each line of color in the spectrum is due to a certain element at a certain temperature. So maybe it's sulfur at 100,000 degrees, maybe it's silicon at 1,000,000 degrees. So one of the things I've done is take the various elements and get them as hot as you get them in a star and look at the spectra that they emit. So we basically make templates, or if you will, fingerprints for each element, and the spectrum changes with temperature. And we take these templates, and the astronomers can make their observations of a star, and they get a spectrum, and they compare it to the templates that we've produced. And they can determine what elements are in the star based on what lines they see in the spectrum. And they can also determine the temperature that those elements are existing at in the star. So they can determine a lot of properties about the gas they're looking at.
How do you get on the Earth gases as hot as the surface of the star? I imagine that's extremely hot and rather difficult to do.
That's true. It's technologically, it's extremely challenging. One way to do it is when something's hot, it moves really fast. So in order to simulate a really hot particle, all you have to do is get it to be moving really fast in the laboratory, and then it's simulating the temperatures that would occur in the star, in the sun, in the galaxy. Now, the way I was doing this experiment, which was done at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories with Peter Beiersdorfer and his group, was you take a beam of electrons and you slam them into a bunch of atoms, and you use this beam of electrons, which are moving really fast, to ionize the atoms, basically to remove electrons from the atoms. And that's similar to what happens in a star. And this fast beam of electrons will ionize the atoms to a really high charge state, meaning that to the point where they're missing a lot of electrons. And that condition, an atom with very few electrons is similar to what occurs in, say, the solar corona or other stellar coronae or in shocks and supernova remnants and such. So that's one way.
Okay. And how do you confine this really hot gas in the lab?
In this case, the ions are trapped by the electron beam that does the ionization.
Okay.
The electrons are negatively charged. The ions are positively charged.
Oh, so they attract to each other.
Exactly.
Neat.
Another way to produce hot gas, it would be, say, a tokamak fusion reactor or something like that, where the gas is confined by magnetic fields. And that's a process that's also been used for spectroscopic studies for many decades now.
So you mentioned sort of simulating conditions you would see in the outer layers of the sun and in supernova remnant shocks.
Mm-hmm.
What other astronomical sources or conditions are you able to sort of recreate in the lab and study on Earth?
The attempts in the laboratory are to try to simulate collision reactions at temperatures as low as 10 Kelvin, that's 10 degrees above absolute zero, to millions of degrees Kelvin. And one particular experiment that I'm working on right now is trying to understand how the first star in the universe formed and how we want to understand the underlying molecular physics that produced the first star. And so in the early universe, about 500,000 years after the Big Bang, you've got these big clouds of atomic hydrogen. And the clouds are gravitationally bound, meaning that the gravity of the cloud is enough to keep it together. And the cloud is slowly cooling and condensing because of the gravitational attraction, and eventually it condenses and forms a star. The way the clouds cool is because there's a small little fraction of molecular hydrogen in the cloud, and the molecular hydrogen cools the cloud by radiating the heat of the cloud away. So if we want to model the formation of the first star, we want to be able to understand how much molecular hydrogen is in the cloud, which means we need to understand how the molecular hydrogen forms, and that's the experiment I'm doing. I'm taking beams of hydrogen atoms, and I'm looking how two hydrogen atoms in the beam can come together and make a hydrogen molecule. So that's one sort of experiment that we do.
And so in this experiment, the molecular hydrogen is the presence of molecular hydrogen in this cloud is responsible for the collapse that leads to the first stars. Is that correct?
It plays an important role in allowing the collapse to happen. There are other mechanisms at play, but for certain times in the evolution of the cloud, the molecular hydrogen is the most important coolant.
And how would you form molecular hydrogen in these clouds? What are the different physical mechanisms that could lead to that?
Well, these clouds are in the early universe, so the only elements that really exist are hydrogen, helium, and a little bit of lithium. And so the only mechanism for the molecular hydrogen to form is through collisions of those three elements. And the dominant collision mechanism involves simply a hydrogen atom colliding, which has a proton in the nucleus and an electron orbiting around it, colliding with an H- anion. That's a hydrogen nucleus, which has two electrons orbiting the nucleus. So you have neutral hydrogen atom, and you have the H- system. They come together, they associate to make H2, which is the hydrogen molecule, and the extra electron gets detached. And that's the reaction that produces molecular hydrogen in the early universe, and that's the reaction that we're trying to simulate here on Earth about 13.5 billion years after it happened.
And so how well is the theoretical prediction for the rate at which this reaction happens understood?
This is really the surprising issue. So we're talking about hydrogen, which is the simplest atom,
right,
making H2, which is the simplest molecule. So one would expect that it was basic quantum mechanics, which has been known since 1925. So where's the problem? Why can't they calculate it accurately? But surprisingly, it's many of these apparently simple systems to calculate are computationally extremely challenging and often computationally intractable. We just don't have enough computing power to be able to accurately calculate many of these needed reactions. And that's why laboratory measurements such as the ones that I do are necessary.
Wow, I wouldn't have guessed that, that would be so hard. What are the densities and temperatures of these clouds that you're trying to simulate? So the densities and temperatures where this molecular hydrogen is being produced in the early universe.
The clouds, basically, I'm interested in the evolution of the clouds from when they're about 10,000 degrees down to temperatures of the cosmic microwave background, or CMB, which at the epochs I'm talking about is on the order of 50 Kelvin. So I want to be able to simulate reactions at temperatures from 10,000 Kelvin down to a couple hundred Kelvin and lower if possible. And the way you simulate reactions that are that low in energy, 10,000 Kelvin doesn't sound very low when room temperature is 300 Kelvin, but from a collision physics point of view, it's a really slow-moving collision. And the way to simulate slow-moving collisions is by getting beams of particles that move really slow relative to one another. So I take two hydrogen beams, and they're moving in the laboratory really fast, but they have nearly the same velocity. So the relative velocity between the two beams is really, really small. And in that way, we can simulate the low temperatures of the early universe.
Okay. And so one project that you've been working on recently is forming the first stars. And
that's
another
correct.
One is the sun. Are there any sort of non-stellar objects which also you've been working on?
Well, right now I'm interested in understanding the beginnings of organic chemistry in space. One of the big questions that is being asked in the field of astrobiology is how much of the raw material necessary for life was synthesized in molecular clouds. This material would then form the, would be incorporated into protoplanetary disks out of which planets such as ourselves formed. So we want to understand how much of the material necessary for life came from gas phase chemistry or from molecular cloud chemistry. And so one question is, like, was interstellar chemistry able to synthesize nucleic acids, or were the molecules that were synthesized simpler than that? And the more complex molecule, organic molecules necessary for life produced at a later stage in planetary development. So I'm interested in doing an experiment to understand the first links in the chain of chemical reactions leading to organic chemistry. That's another example of laboratory astrophysics. In this case, it's more laboratory astrochemistry that doesn't involve stars initially.
And what observations could we do of a molecular cloud to try and find some of these first organic molecules?
They do observations of molecular clouds in almost every band pass, in the ultraviolet, in the optical, and the infrared, in the millimeter, in radio, and they look at molecules that are either emitting light or absorbing light. And molecules, as you can guess, have a very rich spectrum because they have a lot of atoms, and so there are a lot of possible transitions that can occur. And so interpreting spectra from molecular clouds is very, very challenging.
In many cases, astronomers see lines and they have no idea what molecule is producing that. Is that correct?
For a number of instances, but they've had a lot of success in identifying over 150 molecules in space.
Wow.
And surprisingly, most of those molecules involve carbon. So the chemistry of space as we know it is largely organic, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah, definitely. And how much, now there's not much carbon in the universe, is that correct? Or
the universe is 90% hydrogen, 10% helium, and trace amounts of everything else. And when I say trace, I mean like 0.00001% of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and even less of other stuff.
So yeah, that's absolutely fascinating that so many of the molecules that we see are carbon-based as opposed to silicon or sulfur or other atoms like that. Is there a physical reason why we would expect some carbon to dominate? Or?
Well, there's more carbon than silicon and sulfur, but we do see molecules with silicon and sulfur in them. They have been identified. Why is it that over two-thirds of all the molecules that have been identified have carbon in it? That's a really good question. I don't know the answer offhand.
So, Daniel, what are some of the oldest problems that laboratory astrophysics has been trying to answer?
Well, one of the really interesting spectroscopic conundrums has to do with what are called the diffuse interstellar bands. What these are absorption features due to molecules lying along the line of sight to a particular star, basically to almost any star. So the observations are carried out by using the star as basically just a light bulb. So you get a broadband spectrum from the star, and then you get these absorption features in the spectrum that are due to these unidentified molecules absorbing the light at specific wavelengths, at specific colors. And these diffuse interstellar bands, or DIBs as they're called in the community, were first identified in 1919 by Mary Leah Hegger at the Lick Observatory, and have not been identified despite 90 years of observations and laboratory work. The carriers or the causes of these DIBs are still unknown. And one of the really exciting things about trying to understand these DIBs is that they're probably a huge reservoir for organic material in space. So finally being able to identify what causes the DIBs, the molecules that causes them, promises to revolutionize our understanding of organic chemistry in space.
And is there any idea on what molecules are responsible for these absorption lines?
There have been a lot of molecules that have been looked at. For instance, buckyballs, which are 60 carbon atoms arranged in sort of a soccer ball pattern.
Would you expect those in space?
Surprisingly, the answer is yes. They've also looked at more simpler molecules, like 7 carbon atoms. C7 is what the chemical symbol would be. And they basically ruled out C7 as a source for these DIBs. There are a number of people working in the laboratory. The problem really is that the number of possible candidate molecules is, if I may use the word, astronomical. And the amount of time it takes to study any one given molecule and the number of molecules that exist basically means that the amount of time required to study everything is longer than the age of the universe. So we have to try to figure out how to make educated guesses as to what candidate carriers to study. And that's very challenging.
And so there are lots of spectral, if I understand the problem correctly, there are lots of spectral features seen towards stars in the Milky Way. And there's no idea where these absorption lines are coming from.
Well, they're coming from clouds of some kind, diffuse, translucent clouds that are lying along the line of sight. But the molecules in the clouds that cause the absorption are unknown.
And where are these clouds? What is producing these sort of translucent clouds that lie along the line of sight?
The same thing that produces most of the clouds that are observed in space. You get slight gravitational overdensities that attract material, matter, through the gravitational attraction to that point in space, and then it self-gravitates. It, as more matter accumulates, you get stronger gravitational attraction, so you slowly get more matter. That's one of the mechanisms by which molecular clouds are formed.
And what are the densities of the clouds that are believed to be responsible for the diffuse interstellar bands?
That's a really good question. Typical densities for molecular clouds can be on the order of maybe 10 particles per cubic centimeter, sometimes less, sometimes more. It depends upon the stage of evolution that the cloud is going through.
And for these diffuse interstellar bands, are the densities similar to that observed for molecular clouds? Because molecular clouds, if I understood correctly, are so dense that you can't really see stars behind them at all.
Well, there are different types of molecular clouds. They're diffuse, which you can look through. They're translucent, which begin to become opaque. And then they're dense or dark molecular clouds, which you cannot look through.
And the diffuse interstellar bands are sort of are created by clouds in this middle category, is that correct?
Well, the name diffuse gives it away. Largely from diffuse clouds.
Okay. Cool. And so they were first observed in 1919, and nobody really understands nobody understands what is actually doing the absorbing.
Yeah, the molecule's doing the absorbing, and it's not just one molecule, it's a number of different molecules that's doing the absorbing. Haven't been identified.
And absorption lines at these frequencies haven't been observed in denser clouds or things of that nature. So they're unique to these diffuse interstellar bands?
The answer to that would be yes, because the dense clouds don't let the starlight
through,
so you can't. It doesn't mean that the molecules aren't there in the dense clouds. It just means that we can't see them.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much. That was extremely interesting.
Thank you.
And I wish you the best of luck in answering all of these questions.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.